Well, good morning. Happy Mother's Day. All the mothers out there, you know who you are. This past week seemed to fly by. I hope that you had as encouraging, uplifting, and edifying gospel meeting as I did, getting to meet Richie Thetford and get to know him a little better. He did text me yesterday and said that he made it home safely and wanted me to express to the brethren again how much he greatly appreciated and enjoyed being with you all. One of the things that I hope that he wouldn't ask, so I get to ask it, is the question of May. If April showers bring Mayflowers, what do Mayflowers bring? Come on, you all know the answer to that. Pilgrims, right? As Christians, that's what we are. We're pilgrims. May is like the Christian month. We're pilgrims. Well, this also being the second Sunday in May is Mother's Day, as our nation has declared. We're going to talk about that in just a second. So the lesson, and actually the theme for this morning and this evening, is going to be on mothers. This morning's lesson is entitled Mothers, the Good, the Bad, and the Godly. Now, I did ask Leon if he would just hum a few bars of the music that no doubt is running through your head right now. And he said no. So, in just a few minutes, we're going to be turning to Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, and Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 20, and then get started with our lesson. And for you fathers out there, if you're going, whew, we're let off the hook, no, no, your time's coming. Next month, we're going to talk about fathers, the good, the bad, and the godly. But the beginning of Mother's Day, I was always interested as to why is there a Mother's Day, and it hasn't always been around. It actually goes back to October 9th, 1914. When President Woodrow Wilson declared the second Sunday of each May as Mother's Day, he declared it to be a special day to honor mothers of this nation. Now, there had been little local honors of Mother's Day in different areas of the country, but not the whole country. And as it gained popularity over the years, President Woodrow Wilson declared the second Sunday of each May as Mother's Day, and the national holiday has grown in popularity. And though this is a special one-time event each year, we know and we should all understand that we honor our mothers on a daily basis, especially giving honor and praise to our godly mothers, those who are pleasing to God. And there are many lessons we can learn from mothers. When we go back into the scriptures, we can see lessons from mothers as well. When we look into our own lives, mothers teach us what love is. The love of a mother helps us as children. As we grow up, we see that. We understand what love is. We're able to define it because of their love, their sacrifice, the examples that they set before us. But as we look into scriptures, mothers also serve as great examples of godliness, great examples of well-being of their children and of their family. But we also see mothers serving as examples of what not to do, and we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about two examples again this evening, one of a very wicked mother and one of a very godly mother. But in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, I told you to place a marker there. We're going to actually read through verse 9. And Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8 says, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head, and ornaments about your neck." If you go over to chapter 6 and start with me in verse 20. As you're turning there, Solomon here is, as he is inspired to write down these Proverbs. And we get the feeling from Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes, he's writing this in his later years, kind of looking back over a lifetime of being wise, the wisest man in all the earth. And he actually talks throughout the book of Proverbs of trying to gain wisdom. He personifies wisdom. He gives wisdom its own personality. And wisdom wants you to have her. She wants you to be wrapped in her, to know her teachings so that you might be wise and not go down paths that would lead to destruction and wanton living. And so in chapter 6 and verse 20, he says, "My son, observe the commandment of your father, and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life." And he goes on in verse 24 to remind them of the things that these teachings of his father and mother are to keep them from. You know, in today's day and time, we talk about how smart computers are. And in fact, when someone shows a degree of intellect, or we might call them a genius, sometimes we use the phrase, we'll say they're like a walking computer. But have you ever wondered why computers are so smart? Because they listen to their motherboard. Proverbs is teaching us to listen to our mothers. They're telling us, don't forsake our father's commandments. Don't forsake our mother's teaching. Bind them around our neck. It says when we sleep, they'll watch over you. When you awake, they'll talk to you. The commandment is a lamp. The teaching is light. And tells us their discipline is our way of life. Solomon here is telling people, listen to your parents. Listen to them. Follow them. Their teachings and their commandments are for your good. So this morning, we're going to consider the example of mothers in light of the good, the bad, and the godly. So let's get into it, talking about the first example, and that is of the good. And here we're only talking about someone who looked out for the physical well-being of their family. We're not going to make any judgments whether they were morally right, morally wrong. We're talking about a mother that did what was right, what she thought was best for her child. And in this case, we're going to be looking at the account of Bathsheba. Turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 1. Over in 1 Kings chapter 1. To set the stage, as you're turning over there, we're going to be starting in verses 15 through 21. To set the stage here, King David is dying. He has lived a life of righteousness, but he has also lived a life of the consequences for his sin. If we were to turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 12, when Nathan the prophet confronts him about his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband Uriah, God tells David through Nathan the prophet that the sword would never depart from his family, but he was going to have turmoil from the enemies within his own household. And he goes through a civil war where Absalom, where Reed, takes the hearts of the people. In 2 Samuel chapter 15, it says the hearts of the people went with his son Absalom, to the point that David and those loyal to him flee Jerusalem into the wilderness. Again, living the life on a run, as he had done before on the run for his life from Saul. This time from his son, because he really did not want to fight him. Now here on his deathbed, as he lays dying, his fourth son, perhaps the oldest living one at the time, Adonijah, did not wait for confirmation from his dying father, but he took the crown, and he's having a ceremony, having himself crowned king. And even those who were loyal to David, Abiathar the priest, Joab his commander, are with Adonijah. And what we find is Nathan the prophet finds Bathsheba, and he sends her in to David because Nathan the prophet knew that God had promised that her son Solomon would be king. And Adonijah is taking it upon himself to crown himself king, and he's throwing a party. And so we find in verse 15, begin reading with me. So Bathsheba went into the king in the bedroom. Now the king was very old, and Abishag, the Shunammite, was ministering to the king. Then Bathsheba bowed and prostrated herself before the king, and the king said, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "My lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, 'Surely your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne.' Now behold, Adonijah is king. And now, my lord the king, you do not know it. He has sacrificed oxen and fatlings and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the sons of the king, and Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army. But he has not invited Solomon, your servant." And as she says in verses 20 through 21, the real crux of the matter. "As for you now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you, to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will come about, as soon as my lord the king sleeps with his fathers, that I and my son Solomon will be considered offenders." She knows the way of the ancient world of kings. When you took the throne, either by force or by scheme, you didn't leave the rightful heirs alive. And so she's saying, when you pass on, my life and the life of my son Solomon is forfeit. And all eyes of Israel are on you. What are you going to do? And David launched into action. Adonijah, David's fourth son, you go back to 2 Samuel 3, 4, sees that. If he were to become king, she and her son's life would be in jeopardy. She was concerned for his physical well-being. She was concerned for Solomon's physical well-being. She knew his life would be worth nothing if Adonijah went through with the plan. So we find in 1 Kings chapter 1, 28 through 31, we don't have time this morning to read it, but David assured Bathsheba his promise would be done that day and Solomon would be king. And this wasn't just a promise from David. If you want to go over and look in 1 Chronicles 22, 9 to 10, God promised David that Solomon would be king. And in fact, when David has Solomon crowned as king, we read in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 25, God highly exalted Solomon as king more than any other king over Israel. God highly exalted him. God said Solomon would be king. David said Solomon would be king. Adonijah's plan failed. But David didn't know what was happening until Bathsheba went in and told him. She was concerned for her son's physical well-being. We get out of Bathsheba. She was a loving, protective mother to Solomon. But not only Bathsheba, but we can see some noteworthy mentions. We might mention Sarah, or the mother of James and John, the wife of Zebedee. Sarah in Genesis 21, 1 to 14, we read out she was looking for Isaac's physical well-being. There was a time when Isaac was very young that Ishmael mocked him and was making fun of him. And she worried about his physical well-being that she asked Abraham to send Hagar and Ishmael away. And God told Abraham, do what she has asked. We find in Matthew 20, 20 through 23, the mother of James and John, the wife of Zebedee, though she did not fully understand or comprehend the kingdom and its nature, she too is looking out for the well-being of her sons over that of the other apostles, and caused quite a stir when she asked Jesus to make James and John sit at the right hand and the left hand of Jesus when he comes in his kingdom. And though she didn't understand it, she was simply looking out for their physical well-being, because she did not understand Jesus' kingdom was spiritual, not physical. To love and want to protect your children is a good trait for a mother to possess. And so it's right that we honor those mothers that are good. Then we look at the bad. This would be that mother who has a very ungodly influence. And of course, it's hard to talk about ungodly mothers and women in general in the scriptures without turning to Jezebel. In 1 Kings chapter 21 and 25. 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 25. We read off the bat about Ahab's reign as king over the northern 10 tribes of Israel. This is after the kingdom has been split in the north and south. Ahab is a king in the north. And it says about him, surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Notice the next part. Because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. There are some good qualities about Ahab as we look into his life. If we were to do a character study of Ahab, he had some good qualities. But one of his worst qualities was he never seemed to be able to say no to his wife, even when he knew she was wrong. And so, therefore, the record from God says there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. She was the true wicked power behind the throne, wasn't she? We read in 1 Kings 16, 30 through 31, when we're introduced to them, that King Ahab of Israel married Jezebel. She was a Phoenician princess of Tyre. She was the daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians. And because of that, he became an idolater. And between the two of them, they swayed the hearts of Israel to worship Baal and the Asherah. And this was a blight on the land for many years. In 1 Kings 18, 3 through 4, we can read of Jezebel, her ungodly influence. According to 1 Kings 18, 3 through 4, 1 Kings 19, 1 to 2, and 1 Kings 21, 5 through 15, Jezebel hunted down and killed the prophets of God. Ahab said nothing, did not stop her. 1 Kings 19, 1 to 2, she threatened the life of Elijah. And this after the famine was ended. And rain fell upon the land, proving that there was a God over Israel. And she said, Elijah's life is forfeit. He's dead. He's as good as dead this time tomorrow. 1 Kings 21, 5 to 15, She orchestrated the death of Naboth. He would not sell to Ahab his ancestral vineyard. Even though Ahab went and he did the right thing, he offered him money. But Naboth said, this has been in my family. This is my children's inheritance. No, I will not sell. Ahab didn't take it by force. He went home, laid in his bed, and sulked until Jezebel said, you're the king. You deserve to get whatever you want. Let me handle it. And she orchestrated false witnesses, a kangaroo court, and a mock trial. And Naboth is stoned. And then we read of Ahab walking into his newly acquired vineyard when Elijah the prophet comes on the scene and condemns him. Her ungodly influence over her family caused her family's downfall. Her ungodly influence over her family caused so many deaths in their family that the line of Ahab was cut off forever. In 1 Kings 22, 51 to 53, Ahaziah, their son, was killed because of his ungodliness. In 2 Kings 9, 22 to 24 and verse 27, Jehu is crowned king by Elisha the prophet under the order of God. And of his first act is to go kill Joram, the son of Ahab and Jezebel, for his wickedness. And he also kills their grandson, Ahaziah, who is now king of Judah. And we read, and we'll get to that in a second, we read why Ahaziah was killed. But when Athaliah, his mother, she's the daughter of Jezebel and Ahab, 2 Chronicles 22, 3 through 5, when she finds out her son is dead, she goes and has all the royal offspring killed so that she might wipe out the line of David and that she might reign, being of the house of Omri. But she missed one. She missed one. But like her mother was such an evil influence on her son, 2 Chronicles 22, 7 tells us Jehu killing Ahaziah was not just a kill of opportunity. It was judgment from God, so that the house of Ahab might be wiped out. And so we find she was such an evil influence on her son, it says in 2 Chronicles 22, 7, to his destruction. Because we read of him that he was influenced by his mother Athaliah, who was just as evil as her mother Jezebel. She was so evil after her son's death, she killed all but one of her grandchildren just so she could solidify her power as queen. I want you to think about that, mothers and grandmothers. Be able to take your offspring and your grandoffspring and have them put to death. Can you even imagine or contemplate doing it? That's how wicked and evil this woman was. In 2 Kings 10, 1 to 11, under the command of King Jehu, Ahab's remaining 70 sons are killed, and his line is cut off forever. Her influence was so bad, so ungodly, God said, I want them cut off so that there will not be a descendant left to Ahab. She was a mother of such evil influence that she caused her family's downfall. Now, like we had some noteworthy mentions under the ungodly, there are some dishonorable mentions. In a lot of ways, if we were to talk about the life of Rebekah, Rebecca had some redeeming qualities that would fall under the good qualities. But that's not really what we remember her for. We remember her for that dishonorable quality because of the lasting influence that it had. In Genesis 24:67, she was a mother who taught her son to deceive and to lie to gain what he wanted in life. And those lessons plagued Jacob throughout his life, even to the fact that his own children deceived and lied to him and brought such heartbreak that he became a broken man. Now those things all turned around when he later in life found out Joseph was alive. But he suffered the consequences of deceit and lies his whole life. Herodias, Luke 3, 19 through 20, and we're not going to spend too much time talking about her because she's on our list tonight. Herodias was a mother who condoned immoral sensuality and murder, and in fact taught her daughter to use these things to get what she wanted. These mothers are mothers that are examples of what not to do, how not to raise your children before God. And finally, we get to the example of the godly. These are the mothers that look out for not only the physical well-being of their children, not only to be a good influence and example, but to look out for their spiritual well-being. And I had others on this list, and I narrowed it down to one. And to talk about a godly mother, it seemed very difficult to not talk about Mary, who is called blessed and favored of God, blessed of women. In Luke chapter 1, 26 through 38, and we're just going to look at some of the highlights here out of this passage. But in Luke 1, 26 to 38, she's the woman, it says, favored of God, who is chosen to give birth to Jesus, the Son of God. The woman tasked to be his earthly mother in verses 28 through 33 of that same passage. Think of the character and the quality that she must have possessed. For out of all the women in Israel, for God to choose her and say she is entrusted to raise God in the flesh. Fully God, fully man. We find out in verse 34 of Luke chapter 1, she was a virgin. She had kept herself pure before marriage. 1 John 3:3 tells us we're to be pure, for God is pure. She certainly is an example of purity. The angel assured her she'd be carrying the Son of God in verse 35. In verse 38, she humbly submitted to the will of God. I want you to look at the words that she spoke to the angel when all was said and done. And Mary said, "Behold, the bondslave of the Lord. May it be done to me according to your word." And the angel departed from her. She had the attitude to humbly submit to the will of God. Was it going to make life hard and difficult for her? Yeah. In fact, when Joseph finds out she's pregnant, his first reaction is to put her away, because he knows that they had kept themselves pure before marriage. And so when he finds out, he's going to kind of quietly put her away so to save her some embarrassment, save him embarrassment. And it took the angel of the God to say, "No, this is my plan. This is my son. And you will marry her as planned." And so Joseph took her, and they became husband and wife. It made their life hard. In Luke chapter 2, in verse 19, they came to Bethlehem because there was a census. And there was no room in the inn, as we all know the story. And so she gave birth in a stable where there was a manger, and he was born in a manger. We're told that shepherds were told from an angel, and they came from the fields to honor and worship the newborn king. And we read that Mary treasured it in her heart. Chapter 2 and verse 14. Life got another little bit harder as Jesus was a little bit older. They're living in a house now in Matthew chapter 2. And wise men from the east are looking for the child that was born to be king of the Jews. And they come to the house of Herod, or the palace of Herod. And Herod says, "Oh, I want to meet him too. So when you find him, you come back and let me know." But God told the wise men, "No, you leave another way than what you came." And so Herod begins slaughtering, just as Pharaoh of old. He begins slaughtering the children. He begins slaughtering male children, 2 years and younger, telling us Jesus was probably a toddler at this time. And so God tells Mary and Joseph to flee their home and go into Egypt. This too, so prophecy might be fulfilled that out of Egypt his son was called. So in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 14, she and Joseph were obedient to the voice of God. They took Jesus to Egypt and only returned when Herod died in Matthew 2, 19 through 21. Then a little bit later, they took him back home and they were able to have peace from Herod. But then things got a little scary again for Mary. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 48, they'd come to Jerusalem. And Jesus stayed behind at the temple, verses 43 to 44. When Mary and Joseph figured it out, it was 3 days out. Can you imagine? Searching the caravan, you can almost put yourself in their shoes. Because I know what I would do. They searched every wagon. They searched every group of people. Where is he? We're 3 days away. The panic. And they come back to Jerusalem and they find him in the temple. They searched for him, we're told in verse 46. Because she was concerned for his physical well-being. But then verses 50 through 52 of Luke 2, they were the kind of parents that Jesus submitted to, and by them he was trained in wisdom and became favored of God. Look at Luke 2, verses 50 through 52 with me. But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. That's when he said, you should have known I'd be in my father's house, taking care of my father. I had my father's business to take care of in his house. But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth. And he continued in subjection to them. Remember, children are told to honor their parents and to obey them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. She was concerned for his spiritual well-being. She trained him, and he increased in wisdom and in the favor of God and men. And then he comes, around 30 years old, and reveals himself to the world that he is fully God. He is fully man. He is the great I am. And he could do mighty, wondrous things, even calling forth those who have died back from the grave. Who could ever hurt such a one? But we read in John 19, 25 to 27, she followed her son all the way to the cross. That was tough. You know, that was hard for her to do. To hear the things they said about her son, to see what they did to him, to watch him put up as a public spectacle, to be mocked, humiliated. I'm reminded of the words that Simeon told her in Luke 2, 34 to 35. As she watched her son die for the sins of the world, truly her heart was pierced as with a sword. There in the very beginning, as Jesus was a baby, she was told her heart would be pierced as with a sword. And I think no greater example of that than standing at the feet of her son at the cross. But in Acts chapter 1, 12 to 14, her last mention in the scriptures has her listed among believers, including the apostles and the Lord's brothers, her children. Let that sink in. The last mention of her in the scriptures has her knowing that her son returned, walked with mankind for 40 days. As they watched him ascend into the clouds, she's now with them on the day of Pentecost, the first day of the week, in that upper room with the apostles and the Lord's brothers. Her children believed. We read in other places in the Gospels that her brothers had not yet believed, meaning that at a later time they did. And here we find in Acts chapter 1, 12 to 14. She was favored of God. She watched her son die, the one whom she was honored to raise. She got to see him alive again, watched him ascend. And here in the last record of her, she was counted among the believers. Mary was a mother like no other. She was truly blessed among women, as we can read in Luke chapter 1 and verse 42. But as we looked at noteworthy mentions, dishonorable mentions, it would be right and fair to mention some honorable mentions. Jochebed made my list. Remember who Jochebed is? She's the mother of Moses. Go back to Exodus 2, 1 to 2, Exodus 6, 20, and Numbers 26, 59. She was a mother that trusted in God, saved her baby, Moses. And she was a mother who suffered heartbreak too. She did not get to name him. She saved him. But she had to watch from afar as another woman plucks him out of the river, and another woman, Pharaoh's daughter, names him. But then she gets to raise him until he is weaned. And she raised him to the point that when God says to Moses in his later years, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses didn't say, who? I know who Ra is. I know who Amun is. Who are you? He knew who Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are. Not from Pharaoh's daughter, but from his mother. She trained him to have faith in God. She was a mother not only concerned about physical well-being, but also his spiritual well-being. And then Hannah. 1 Samuel chapter 1, 1 to 2. She was a mother who put God first, even in fulfilling her vow to God. So many people will pray to God in their times of need and distress. Lord, if you'll only do this, I will do this. You do Y for me, I'll do X. And then God blesses them. He answers their prayer. and they don't obey it. There's some that say, if you do this, I'll stop drinking, I'll stop doing drugs, whatever it is. And God answers their prayer, and they're like, that might have been just coincidence. Hannah prayed to God for a child. She wanted a son. She was barren. God heard her prayer, opened her womb. She had Samuel, and she said, if you give me a son, I will dedicate him to you. And how easy it would have been, as she weaned him, to say, this is my son that God blessed me with. I'm going to keep him. But at the proper time, she brought him to the tabernacle and entrusted him to the high priest Eli and said, I dedicated him to God. That must have been difficult. She saw him once a year and she brought him new clothing then. She put God first, even in fulfilling her vow to dedicate her son Samuel to God. And as you go back and look in chapter 1 and 2 of that passage in 1 Samuel, she was blessed for it. Every child ought to be so thankful for mothers who have showed their love and devotion, sacrificial love for their family. Mothers who are concerned not only for our physical well-being, but our spiritual well-being. Who would put God first to teach us valuable lessons in life. We find that a godly mother will diligently train her children to know God. Remember Proverbs 1:8, hear my son, your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. In Proverbs 6:20, my son, observe the commandment of your father, and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. A godly mother will not forsake her God-given role as a teacher of her young. In Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. It's not just the father to discipline, but also the mother. We are to train them. A godly mother will be a godly example for her children. I think of 2 Timothy 1, 3 through 5, about the example of Lois and Eunice. I don't want to say too much about them. We're going to talk about them tonight. They're our second example this evening. But in 2 Timothy 1, 3 through 5, Paul says, I thank God whom I serve with a clear conscience, the way my forefathers did, as I constantly remember you in my prayers night and day, longing to see you even as I recall your tears, so that I may be filled with joy. For I'm mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I'm sure it's in you as well. As we are going to talk about them tonight, you're going to see that not only did they bring that sincere faith into the life of Timothy by example, but they taught him the scriptures from his youth up. Many good examples can be said of Lois and Eunice. As we think about mothers, the good, the bad, and the godly. As we dwell on those who are godly, godly mothers deserve our praise because they watch over our souls. They instilled those things in us as we were young. And we ought not to depart from those things. The question this morning is, what kind of mother are you or will you be? The good, the bad, or the godly? This morning, if you're not a Christian, you need to be. To repent of your sins, to be baptized for the forgiveness of those sins, baptized into not only Christ's name, but baptized into the church that he purchased with his own blood. If you are a member this morning, not living the way that you should, remember the things that you have been rescued and saved from. We've been rescued out of the world of darkness. Don't go back into it. We've been rescued out of it and brought into the light of his kingdom. You need to repent and be restored. If we can assist you in anything this morning, if you're subject to an invitation in any way, come forward and let it be known now while we stand and while we sing.